Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. On today's program, Ellen talks with an eminent Canadian statesman, Dr. Paul Hellyer, who has decades of experience working at the highest levels of government and who describes the ongoing plans by a handful of people who actually run the world.
The whole idea was that the bankers were to get control of the system to the point where they could regulate any and all individual economies in the world system. This is sort of the first and worst big leap in the direction of this autocracy in world government. And that just means that it takes its orders from the few elite bankers of the world who are the apex of the cabal.
Dr. Paul Hellyer, today's guest with Ellen on It's Our Money. Later on the Public Banking Report, we'll get some personal insights on why people are getting motivated to help create publicly owned banks around the U.S. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, I'm really keen to get to our speaker, but first I wanted to discuss my latest article a bit and what's going on in Ireland. I'll be there for the Kilkenny Festival, which is in Kilkenny, Ireland, and it's supposed to be a combination of economics and humor. You might wonder what's funny about economics, but I guess you have to laugh in order to keep from crying or getting angry. And you could see why the Irish particularly could be angry at this point, because their economy is in pretty dire straits, and it's because their government bailed out their major banks in 2008, and the taxpayers have been paying for it ever since, and the banks were hugely profligate, irresponsible in their behavior, but they still got bailed out. And so now the government had to get bailed out itself in 2010, so they had to get a loan from the EU and the IMF. Well, these are not the parties you want to get loans from, because the IMF will make you privatize all your assets as needed to pay off the loan, lay off government employees, and generally go into austerity mode, cut back on public services. So the latest outrage in Ireland, which they were just protesting about on Saturday, November 1st, is that their water, which up till now has been free, the water company was privatized, and so now they're being charged for their water. So there were over 100 protests involving over 100,000 people. So people are pretty upset about the water issue. And it's very similar to what just happened in Detroit, where the water company has shut off the water for people who couldn't pay. And this was, of course, because the company was privatized. And this is a city where people can't pay because they can't get jobs. And all that, again, is due to the credit crisis, which was the fault of the banks, not the fault of the people. So in Detroit as well, they've been protesting heavily. In fact, they would argue that water is a human right. What do we have government for if it's not to provide a sort of social safety net so that we can't die from lack of water or those basic things? Like, we should have ready access to water, roads and bridges, power, and some sort of social safety net in case we can't earn a living ourselves, either because we can't get a job due to the economic conditions or because we're incapacitated in some way, or we're just too old to work, or we're just old enough that we deserve to retire after working for many years. And I would argue that another thing government should provide is ready access to credit, and business, local, small and medium-sized businesses are having a lot of trouble with that, both in the U.S. and in Ireland. So that's the reason I got invited to Ireland. I had gone there a year ago to speak about the possibility of setting up a network of public banks to help with their local businesses to get credit and their homeowners, et cetera, and also to help the government fund infrastructure and social services at half the cost because they wouldn't have to pay interest to outside lenders. So I gave several PowerPoints while I was there, and we met with government officials and so forth. And after I left, then they met with several times some officials from the Sparkassen group in Germany, which is the public and savings banks and local community bank network in Germany, which has been responsible for the German economy doing so well, particularly their local businesses. So they came over to advise on how the Irish could set up a network similar to the Sparkassen network in Germany. And they've talked to government officials, and there at least two of the political parties are quite interested in this now. So when I'm over there, I'll be meeting with people as well and seeing if I can help move that along again some more. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about before getting to our illustrious guest is my latest article, which was prompted by my previous article, which evoked a question that I thought I would answer in this article. So the name of the article was, "Why do banks want our deposits? Hint, it's not to make loans." I had written in my previous article that the Bank of England recently admitted, basically, that contrary to popular belief, banks do not lend their deposits. They create deposits in the process of making loans. So then the question arises, well, if they don't need our deposits, if they're not lending our deposits, why are they always scrambling to get them? They even pay us interest, not much interest, but a little bit of interest, in order to get our deposits. So I wrote in this response that they don't need the deposits to create loans. In fact, they create deposits in the process of creating loans, but they do need them to balance their books. So they have to get the deposits in some way to balance their books. So I ran my article past my local friendly critics before I posted it, and the objection arose that this was a pretty academic question and, you know, people might not really care about it. But when I posted the article, it wound up on Seeking Alpha, and it got over 200 comments. So it's obviously a hotly debated issue in some circles, and it provokes a lot of controversies. And I got an email from my daughter, who lives in Switzerland, who forwarded an email in German from someone who had written to his list and said something like, "Aha, Ellen Brown has admitted that she was wrong in Web of Debt, where she said that banks create 97% of our money supply. Now she's admitting that they need their deposits in order to balance their books, so that's effectively the same as lending their deposits." So that's what I wanted to talk about now. I want to respond to that. Oh, and then he added, which I thought was kind of charming, he said, "But at least Americans, unlike Europeans, don't seem to mind changing their minds." And so, to which I would respond, "Yes, it's true. I don't mind changing my mind." I think John Maynard Keynes said that when presented with new facts, he will change his mind. But I haven't changed my mind on this particular issue. Banks do create the vast majority of our money supply. It may not be 97%, as it was in 2007 when I first published Web of Debt, because the Federal Reserve is now jumping in there and creating money by quantitative easing, but it's still the vast majority. And in fact, you could argue, first of all, that the Fed is a bank and it lends money into the system at interest. It doesn't just spend it as it would if it were the Treasury. And B, that the quantitative easing money does not actually make it into the circulating money supply. It doesn't get beyond the reserve accounts of banks, but that's a very complicated issue, and that wasn't the point I wanted to make. The point I wanted to make was that banks do create deposits on their books, and they do need deposits to clear their checks. So it's an apparent anomaly. It looks like a contradiction, and here's how you can explain it. Where do the deposits come from that they need to balance their books? They have been created by some bank somewhere. All those every deposit is created by a bank except for coins, which are the only money issued by the Treasury. And if you want to even if you want to count dollar bills as created by the government, they're created by a bank. So they do come into the system as a loan at interest. So it goes like this. Bank A makes a loan, which creates a deposit, which goes into Bank B. Then, to balance its books, Bank A has to attract an equivalent sum in deposits back. So it can either do that by borrowing back the very deposit that it created, which will now be in some other bank in the form of excess reserves, or it can attract more deposits from other banks in some way by attracting new customers or getting new money in from its customers. So it's basically a check-cutting scheme. The bank creates money, it goes into another bank, and the original bank then borrows it back or attracts it back in some other way. So if that issue interests you, you can read more about it on my blog at ellenbrown.com. But now I do want to get to our honored guest who has much to say. He's written 14 books and has served a long and very distinguished political career spanning 7 decades. As our opening clip from him shows, he is well aware of the powerful intrigue and megalomania that underlies the world's economic powers. He knows the inside story of the world's power brokers and their willingness to bend outcomes to their own benefit. And at this point in his long and very venerable career, he isn't inclined to mince words. It is my great honor and pleasure to be speaking with the Honorable Paul Hellyer, one of Canada's best known and most controversial politicians. He is also one of Canada's oldest and most experienced politicians. He was first elected to the Canadian House of Commons in 1949, when he was the youngest member ever to have been elected there. He went on to serve as National Defense Minister, among other noteworthy posts. In 1997, he formed his own political party, the Canadian Action Party. He has reemerged in the media of late by coming out on a very controversial subject, the intervention of extraterrestrials in our planetary politics. All these subjects and more are covered in his newly released book, The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. So there's much to talk about. Welcome, Paul.
It's great to talk to you, Ellen.
Thank you. Your new book covers a broad range of topics, but I'll start with the back cover. It says, Paul Hellyer's amazing book reveals how a small group of greedy men usurp the people's power and use politicians to transfer that power to a cabal dedicated to a new world order imposed by an unelected, unaccountable world government. The money crisis, high unemployment, and a lost generation of young people are directly attributable to a rotten banking system that makes us all slaves to debt. This book explains the black nature of the money mafia at the apex of the cabal. It, meaning the cabal, also controls the extraterrestrial file, but denies that fact vehemently. So that's all very provocative. This is actually your 13th book. That puts you one ahead of me. I've written 12.
And actually 14.
14. Sorry. I was reading off your...
So up to me for next year.
Okay. So you've gotten to where you definitely deserve to rest on your glories and just enjoy your retirement. What prompted you...
Happy thought, not likely to happen.
So I was just wondering, though, what prompted you to write this last book? And particularly coming out with that controversial extraterrestrial connection.
Well, actually, when I wrote Light at the End of the Tunnel, which I think you saw about 4 years ago, I thought that was my last book on any serious subject. I thought I might do an autobiography someday if I got around to it, but I'd had no intention of writing this present book. Well, then information began coming to me on the Internet, from varied sources, which I found very disturbing, all on the public record, that in effect there are two governments in America, the one that people think of. They think that the president and the Congress are running the country, but that is not really the case. For several decades at least, there has been a shadow government, and It's the real government of the United States, and it, in my opinion, is taking the U.S. and the world down the wrong path. It is touting a new world order under which we would have an autocracy, a government that was unelected and run by bankers and elite people. And this, in my opinion, is untenable. We've fought for two world wars and since for democracy, and it's going down the drain, and it's going down the drain deliberately at the hands of these people who think that they are smarter and that maybe they have some divine right to rule the rest of us and keep us in bondage and have us do their work for them. So when I found that all out and had a chance to check it out, and information along those lines still kept rolling in, I said, this is something that the American people have to be exposed to. They have to know what's been going on in their country since General Eisenhower lost control of the extraterrestrial file years ago and warned us about the military-industrial complex, as he called it. He didn't name the ET file, which is a mistake, or at least unfortunate, I think. But one of Dr. Stephen Greer's witnesses who worked with Eisenhower is absolutely convinced that he was referring to the fact that he had lost control. In other words, the government had lost control of the ET file, which had fallen under the control of this other group. Eisenhower was actually so incensed because they wouldn't tell him what they were doing in Nevada and Arizona and some of the underground bases that he threatened to send in the Third Army if they didn't let his representatives go and see what was going on. So as a result, I think two or three of his closest confidants were allowed to go out and look at Area 51 and Area 28 and S4 and some of the others to see what was happening and report back to him. But that is the last time that we know of that a president has been able to directly intervene and find out the truth about what's been going on out there for the last 60 years. So what has grown up is a shadow government, and it's so powerful. And President Bill Clinton, for example, responded to a question by White House reporter Sarah McClendon about why he didn't do something about UFO disclosure. And Clinton replied, and I quote, "Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it," end of quote. Now, isn't that something? The commander-in-chief of the United States of America, the most powerful country in the world, and the person allegedly with their finger on the atomic button that could destroy the world, doesn't know what his subordinates are doing. And that's just how serious the situation is, and it compelled me to say the people of the United States primarily, but not only people of the United States, because we're all involved in this, have the right to know what this cabal has been doing over the years and what they have in store for us, besides just the bondage of being in debt to the point where we can't survive well.
You talk about a cabal. Who do you mean by the cabal, or do we know?
Well, it's sort of a loosely knit net, but I describe it in terms that I think is about as understandable as it's possible to make it. And that is, it's headed by the international banking and financial system, the banking cartel. They're at the apex of the whole thing. And of course, you know the power of money better than anybody else that I know. And so they use this power to control everyone right down the line. And then below them, the oil cartel, which wants to keep cashing in its checks, its chips in the oil business, even at the risk of the world going up in flames, which it's doing and which it will do unless we do something about it very, very soon. And then below that, the international corporations, the transnational corporations, which, as you have pointed out from time to time, are for the most part controlled by the banking cartel, and then down to the intelligence communities, mostly in the United States, but some elsewhere, primarily the CIA, the FBI, and certainly the NSA, the National Security Agency, which is eavesdropping on everybody in the world that they can possibly eavesdrop on, in preparation probably or likely for the New World Order when they want to know who's on side and who isn't. And then below that, a huge slice of the U.S. Armed Forces. And you put those all together and give them the loose name of cabal, which can also be referred to in the American context as the alternate government, which in fact has run the United States and much of the Western world for nearly all of the post-war years.
I heard Laura Eisenhower, she's Eisenhower's granddaughter, and she talks about this a lot. And she says, we don't need to worry about an extraterrestrial invasion. It's already happened. We have been invaded. So it's a matter of disclosing who they are and what they're up to.
Well, or that they're working with humans for a cause that they think is in common, but which, in my opinion, is not really or necessarily in common. Something that I have to add to this, and that is right after the war, the United States brought over a number of Nazi scientists to aid, presumably, in the war against Japan and the Cold War. And there were a lot of them. And President Truman had insisted that nobody that was active in the Nazi Party be brought in. But, of course, the military, as you might expect, paid no attention to that and just brought them willy-nilly. And then gave them new names and personas and appointed them to the high positions in the United States, in the military and in civil life, so that they had tremendous influence. And coming back to the cabal, the problem is that the cabal controls the technology. They control the patents to the technology. And somehow they have to be forced to give that, they have to bring that out in public. I don't know if it requires a presidential decree or not, but the problem is that the presidents have been under the control of the cabal, and to get them to go against the wishes of the cabal is very difficult for them to do, and it could be very risky. But somebody somewhere has got to do it.
Well, all that is so interesting, but this is a show about money, so we really should get back to the money issues, which you've also written a lot about, and of course I've written a lot about. I would start with the Bank of Canada, which you know about because you're there, and you've written, and I've written that between 1939 and 1974, they had a really great system where the Bank of Canada issued credit, which the government borrowed and then did all sorts of improvements across the country, did your medical system and so forth. And then something happened in 1974. And I wondered if you could explain how they lost that power, why they gave it up. I mean, you were actually in government at that time.
I wasn't in government in 1974, but let me tell this little story about I'm a child of the Depression, obviously from my age, and I saw poverty in its rawest form. And in 1938, there were no jobs in Canada, none, period. And 1939, the war came along, and pretty soon everyone was in the armed forces or building factories or making munitions, and unemployment went down to an historic low of 1%, which seems incredible today, but we would probably settle for 3 or 4. Anyway, people would ask, well, where did the government get the money to do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is the Bank of Canada printed it, printed. And the system, and I'll go into it a little more fully because it's you I'm talking to, the system was the government of Canada gave bonds to the Bank of Canada, and the Bank of Canada printed money for the government and gave it to them, cash, and the government spent the cash into circulation to pay the members of the armed forces and to pay for the factories that were being built and so on. And that cash, as it was spent into circulation, wound up in the private banks, is what the economists then called high-powered money, and was used for the bankers to expand their credit facilities and to finance more factories and allow people to buy war bonds and so on. In effect, what was happening was that the money creation function was being shared between the government of Canada and the private banks. And as you say, this system continued until 1974. And during that period, it helped us to build the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Trans-Canada Highway and the great new airport terminals, and, as you also suggested, to lay the foundation of one of the best social security systems in the world. Well, then along came 1974, and the Bank of Canada unilaterally changed the system and stopped taking its orders, well, stopped working in the interests of its shareholders, the Canadian people, and started taking its orders from the Bank for International Settlements in Zurich, Switzerland. And why that was done, I don't know. I think they were offered a post on one of the BIS committees. But for whatever reason, they made two decisions that proved to be fatal as far as I'm concerned. One was that they would try controlling inflation by interest rates, raising interest rates to exorbitant levels, as they did in 81, 82, and again in 1991, and put millions of people out of work and bankrupt thousands of businesses and put hundreds of thousands of people out of their homes, just a social disaster. But also the disaster was that the governments all went in deficit and started having to borrow in the market, because the other part of the decision was that central banks should no longer provide cheap money to their governments. They had to borrow in the market at market rates. So in 1974, that's what we had to start to do. So we started accumulating deficits and then debt. And as I think you first pointed out, that resulted in us paying interest of $1,100 million from 1974-75 until 2010-11, none of which was necessary. Now, you kind of want to know who made the decision. Well, the Bank of Canada made the decision, and as far as I know, it was unilateral, and the government was never consulted nor advised. Mm. I'm not even sure that the governor of the Bank of Canada knew what he was doing.
Right.
He was being taken for a ride, and I'm afraid that may have been the case. But in any event, it was the beginning of a new era of Friedmanism and of basically unregulated banks or self-regulated banks, where they have been able to do whatever they pretty well jolly well pleased and change the system as a result from a cash reserve system, a partial reserve cash, to a capital adequacy system. I always say capital inadequacy, because who knows what's adequate and what isn't. But it's an entirely different system, and the banks can control it, because if some of the very wealthy people of the world decide they want to have more credit capability, they can just bring a little bit of the money that they've got hidden offshore back and increase the capital of their banks and multiply it by 20 and start making a lot more money and accumulating more of the assets worldwide when they already own the vast majority of them. So it's a decision of really, in effect, centralized control of the banking system. And I think it was Professor Quigley, who had worked with the bankers, who wrote, and he was a mentor of President Clinton's too, that the whole idea was that the bankers were to get control of the system to the point where they could regulate any and all individual economies in the world system. And they, in effect, would have the control as to how much unemployment there was and how fast the economy would grow and all of the things which, you know, you would think that they should be under the control of the government of the country, and which is responsible to the people. But instead, this is sort of the first and worst in its consequences, a big leap in the direction of this autocracy and world government, where that power is centralized with the Bank for International Settlements, and that just means that it takes its orders from the few elite bankers of the world, who are, as I suggested, the apex of the cabal. And we have to regain control of the banking system. I say that it is like a serpent, and it's been coiling itself around individual economies and the Western world economy like a snake. And it's been getting tighter and tighter and tighter as the amount of debt got higher and higher. And it's just like a serpent that's squeezing the Western worlds, wittingly or otherwise, to the point where, you know, it's going to be in terrible, terrible trouble. Well, it is in terrible trouble. It has been and still is. And the only way to do something about that is to cut the head of the serpent off. And then, as you and I would agree, we have to nationalize organizations like the Fed. It should have been done 101 years ago. But certainly, when everybody realized almost immediately after the legislation had been passed what a terrible, terrible mistake this was, Woodrow Wilson realized that, and others, and said he had a quote that somebody used on the air last night of the consequences, which were disastrous for the United States. And yet 100 years has gone by, and the Congress hasn't done anything about it. So they have to take control of the Fed, because there will be no justice in this world until the Fed has been abolished and power has been returned to the government of the United States of America through its own central bank, and the Fed will stop meddling in the affairs of all the other government economies and central banks around the world, because that is number one, and they have to start by the governments creating some money and spending it into circulation, just as the Canadian government did in 1939. And I have a formula that I put in the book where I say that 34% of all the new money created should be created by government. And the reason I picked that number was that it reduces the present leverage of the banks from 20 to 1 to 2 to 1, which they were at the time that the Bank of England was first chartered 300 years ago. And it also provides governments with enough cash to balance their books at reasonable tax rates at all levels, the federal, the state, and the municipal. I suggested, not only myself, but some other people, and you were originally a member of the group, that the Bank of Canada accept shares from the Canadian government that were non-convertible, non-transferable, and non-redeemable instead of bonds, so that we wouldn't have to go through the charade of paying in and out. Just make it a clean deal, take shares from the country, and they have some nominal amount. In Canada, we were suggesting $10 billion each, and that they start out by creating $150 billion a year for our country for 7 years approximately. And this $150 billion would be split 50-50 between the federal government and the provinces, who would then look after the municipalities. And that would solve all of our problems. And if you did that over 7 years, it would also allow for the present debt to be reduced by somewhere between 25% and 33%, depending on how much help they decided to give to poorer nations and how much of their debt they intended to write off in sort of getting away with these odious debts that they have owed to the Western world. So it's a win-win situation, and it would end the power of the cabal, because its head would have been cut off. And then we could start by doing the other things that we have to do and getting disclosure of what they intend to do with the...
The only problem is, how do you get those changes made, since the cabal is in control of Congress, owns Congress and owns the president pretty much. But anyway, I totally agree in principle. It seems to me that what went wrong, like in 1974, was bad economic theory. Not that they probably, whoever, the BIS or the international bankers, no doubt knew what they were doing, but the bad economic theory included, first of all, that they were blaming, there was stagflation then, and they were blaming it on governments creating too much money. So
Milton Friedman said, inflation is always everywhere a monetary phenomenon, but it's not. It's the inflation then was due to oil had quadrupled, so everybody had to raise their prices for oil. And labor was strong then, and so they were demanding that they get paid more. So the producers had to add all those costs to their prices. And then when interest rates went up, the idea is that if you increase the interest rate, that'll make it harder to borrow, and therefore people won't borrow, and so that'll reduce the money supply. Again, on the theory that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, which it's not. So instead, what happened when interest rates went up to 20% was it totally increased costs. So it did not cure the inflation problem. And you had like third world countries that couldn't possibly pay off these debts. So they wound up further into debt, even though they had paid off their original debt several times over, they were still further in debt than they were to start with.
You're absolutely right. And the another one of my books called Miracle in Waiting, Economics That Makes Sense, I pointed out some of the errors in Friedman's proposition. He said that, you know, for 100 years in 100 countries, inflation had always been correlated with the increased money supply, more or less maybe technically correct. But I said, it's like saying for 100 years in 100 countries, winter follows summer. But it doesn't say, you know, whether the summer is warm or cold and whether it's wet or dry and whether it had good crops or bad crops. And as far as the formula is concerned, even in spite of the oil blip, and I think in the United States, if I remember calculating it out, it was never more than a little over 2% of the increase in the consumer price index. The rest was due, as it was in other countries like Canada and, all the Western countries, it was because wages were going up at a multiple of productivity. And so it was cost push inflation, wage push inflation.
Yeah.
And just kept going on and on. And then, of course, the bad economic theory would say, well, we'll take a sledgehammer or an atomic bomb
right.
to the economy and we'll blast it so that it'll stop going where it's going, but in the meantime, we'll wreak havoc with people's lives. And
yeah, so we'll kill demand, so there won't be any business out there. So the producers will have to lower their prices to sell their products. But that's not the way it works.
But of course,
they don't lower their prices; they go out of business because they have to cover their costs.
But the transnationals don't lower their prices; they just lay off people.
Right. And then today, so it just shows, I mean, today we have all this economic theory, which clearly isn't working. I mean, we're at the mercy of people who are tinkering with economies, not really knowing what they're doing. It's like one experiment after another. So you can just see how wrong it can go, because it certainly has gone quite wrong before.
It's terrible, Ellen. You pointed out, for example, that the quantitative easing, which is just a nice word for printing money, has not done what it was supposed to do. But the reason is because that money went into the hands of the banks and not the people.
Right. It's never jumped out of Wall Street. Yeah.
Sure. If some of that money had been available to governments to split with the states to hire or increase wages of teachers and health workers and other people, and to replace infrastructure and do the other things that are positive and needed to be done, then the economy would have bounced back. But instead, it went into the hands of the banks, who only lend if they've got ready borrowers. And with everybody so far in debt, there are very few willing borrowers around. So the banks started buying up assets and buying up securities and pushing up stock prices and all of that sort of thing to make money for themselves, but without any real thought or advantage to the people whose money was being diluted, you know. And it's a dreadful theory. And why people would put up with it, I don't know it, but it's, as you say, it's because they don't understand how the system works. And if you've got a bunch of leaders who don't understand how the system works, and they all have people working for them who are probably moles of the big bankers who have been sent there to give them advice and tell them what to do, well, it gets to be a pretty hopeless situation. And that's the reason I think we've got to try and get this news out to so many people so that somewhere along the line they could say, whoa, you know, enough is enough already. And let's start doing something for the people.
Well, it seems to me that we probably will have another crisis like we had in 2008 because we know that the Dodd-Frank Act didn't fix it and it's got more loopholes it's actually created more loopholes than it's fixed. And then when that happens, it seems to me that's the point of us writing and writing and writing and trying to get this information out there. We really don't have any leverage over Congress, and to the idea of getting a whole political party to put our candidates in there, it seems like an impossible thing. But if they tip over the edge again, and this time Congress has already said we're not going to bail out the banks. What they say they're going to do is bail in their creditors, which means us, the depositors, but that could start a revolution right there. So if they know there are these other alternatives out there, for example, look what Roosevelt did in 1933. The banks collapsed. They were all going bankrupt, and he said, fine, closed all the doors. Declared a bank holiday, and then when he opened the doors again, he said, well, guess what? We're not going to be on the gold standard anymore. So they fixed the system just by changing the monetary system. In fact, right. I've just written an article that I haven't posted yet that we've changed the system every 20 or 30 years for the last 300 years. It's just routine that every time things go wrong or whatever, the government, they don't actually let the system collapse. They change the rules. So I'm hoping they would change the rules. Be sensible enough to change the rules when need be, when the crisis
One rule
occurs.
That they've often talked about but haven't done is to make it a criminal offense for banks or anyone in the financial business to make contributions to political candidates, either incumbents or hopefuls. And if they stop talking about it and do it, that would certainly make Congress perhaps a little bit more independent in their thinking about revising the system and starting to and getting rid of the Fed and starting creating some government debt-free money and doing mm-hmm. things that would be good for the people. But it comes down to the fact that as of now the cabal has the money and it talks and it is really running the world, and all we have are the numbers. But the question is, how do you mobilize a few million people to get together and say, we want something, that we want the Fed wound up, or we want to make it illegal?
I think the problem is that we don't have a plan. We don't know what to get together on. And that's why you and I and all these other people keep writing in order to say, look, here's an easy solution. Let's get behind this one. Of course, my thing now is all public banks. It seems to me there's not much hope of fixing the system at the federal level. We don't have any power at the federal level. Congress is totally deadlocked. But we can approach our local elected officials, and they're quite open to the idea. They're desperate. They know they're not getting help from the federal government, and they've run out of money. Some are tipping into bankruptcy. Like, look at Detroit.
Yeah.
It's a shocking example.
Sure.
So they're open to new ideas, and if we can get across to them that here's a way, set up your own bank. You don't need to put your money in Wall Street, pull it out of Wall Street, do the same thing that the bankers are doing, which is, like you say, use this capital adequacy rule to multiply your capital many times over, essentially, and leverage your capital. And here we can do it like 10 times.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful, and I hope it works, but the bank that should be public bank is the Bank of the United States.
The Fed, yeah.
And that's the one that is going to make the biggest difference the fastest, if it could be done. And it can only be done if a few million people say we want it done and we're not going to vote for any candidate in the future that won't support it. If I could make a plug for my book.
Of course.
What I do, I put in a whole list of suggestions there, not only the banking, but on global warming, suggesting uh-huh. that we should try to get the exotic fuels in the public domain and mm-hmm. And try and replace the fuel supply in every car, truck, tractor, boat, and ship, and airplane, and home in the whole world in 7 years, and do it exactly the way that we did to win World War II, which I remember very well, When we took all the car factories and the manufacturers of refrigerators and stoves and converted them all to ammunitions of one kind or another. Well, today we should do just the opposite and take all of the military-industrial complex factories and convert them into building those small little boxes of zero-point energy that we need to put in the cars and trucks and the planes and homes worldwide. And it would provide more jobs rather than fewer, so we don't need to worry about unemployment, regardless of the fact that this is often given as an excuse for not doing it, and save the world from further overheating before it's too late. But these things are all tied together, and so I just sort of put a list of the most important priorities there and the what should be done about each one, and I admit that it's a long shot, but have to keep plugging, as you do, week after week and day after day, and in the hope that finally somebody will catch on to the fact that there is a better way to run the world, and it's about time we smartened up before we're taken over.
Then to just get to some small things that only probably we theorists care about, but you had discussed the 100% reserve solution at one point, and you said, I've never been able to convince myself that this is the preferred solution, so I just wondered if you could say what you think the problem is there and
sure.
How you would... What
no, I'm against it. First of all, I don't trust politicians with that much power. That would be give them the same
kind
of...
I guess we should say what it is first for people that...
That means the government's printing 100% of the money instead of 34%, as I'm proposing, or is near zero, about 3% today, that they settle for an intermediate amount, which meets the old test of checks and balances. Because politicians, anxious to get reelected, if they had the total power over the purse, would be, I think, they would persuade themselves, because they would think it's essential for them to get reelected rather than the other guys, to start running the printing presses in order to get reelected. And that should be prevented, and it would be under the system I'm proposing. So it's a matter of putting the brakes on. And the other thing is, it disrupts the system too much, because when you start looking at the portfolios of pension plans and so on, if you were to go to a system of 100% reserves, it would just be too disruptive.
Yeah, it seems to me that we need the banking function. I mean, banks create our credit. And the theory of the 100% reserve solution is that you're only lending existing money. And like
exactly.
You said, existing money would come from the government. But what if you want to expand your money supply? I mean, you've got to wait for the government to decide that you need more money. And what about simple things like credit cards? I mean, do you have to check every time you go to buy your dinner? Does the bank have to check and see if they've got the reserves before they can advance credit so that you can buy your dinner on a credit card? I mean, it's just...
No, but I think they should have tighter controls on credit cards, because the banks have used them in a very irresponsible way. They have no cross-check or no cross-control on them, and they've put people in debt so far that they're getting these notices saying if they just pay the minimum amount, which some are, that they'll pay it off in 118 years or 160 years. And this is ridiculous. And it's just
and
because
they run
the banks
out huge debts, and they don't realize the power of compound interest. They don't realize
absolutely,
how much the debt
absolutely.
Is that they're running up.
No, yeah. it's a sad situation.
And then you formed your own political party. Do you want to discuss why and what your platform is?
It was just to propose the monetary reform. It was a monetary reform policy party, and I was naive enough to believe that if you invent a better mousetrap, that people come knocking on your door. And that was real naivety because, on the contrary, and particularly because the press is so controlled, they just ignored it. And I spent a lot of money, which would have been better spent trying to educate people at various levels.
I know. I ran for California State Treasurer. Not that I thought I would get elected, but I was definitely naive and I had no idea what I was getting into. But it's good experience. It's good to hear from your experience. I won't try setting up a political party for monetary reform.
No, I recommend against that. People often write and say, tell me how to start a new party, and I said, don't. Go on, join one of the present ones and start getting a soapbox and trying to convert them, change their minds on something.
Well, I have lots of other questions about sort of fine points of money, but I think we've pretty much run out of time. Is there anything else you feel strongly about adding? Anything else in your solution package that people should know about?
No, I covered my solutions are the macro solutions. There are all kinds of micro solutions that I don't cover because there's not enough space. It would be a 1,000-page book instead of 300.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the micro problems are easier to solve once you solve the macro problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I stick pretty well to the macro, both the politics and economics and the interrelation between them. But I say to the people of the United States and others, if you're the least bit interested in the future of your country and in the future of the world, get a copy of the book, read it carefully, and then hook up with others who feel strongly about some of the reforms and start using the social media to put the numbers together. Because the springs that occurred in two or three countries in the last decade showed what the social media can do. And if we could just get that critical mass, which understands that something has got to be done, and then to pick two or three of the top things that have to be done and demand that they be done, it would be a wonderful move, but it can only happen if we get a sort of a nucleus going, like an atomic bomb. You can have to have the nucleus, and then eventually you can have the kind of explosion that you really need. A revolution of heart and mind is what is required, and it also means, as I say in the postscript, that people have to start acting more responsibly individually, and instead of making gold their god, to start thinking about other people and trying to do things that will be of benefit to the world, so that we can leave the planet a little bit better than when we get here rather than worse.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much, Ellen. You've been an inspiration on the monetary front. And I wish you well and your organization in establishing state banks. And
thank you. You're an inspiration as well.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. We've been talking to the Honorable Paul Hillier, the author of 14 books. His latest book is The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. And he was the former Defense Minister of Canada.
On the public banking report this week, some comments from Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez about why the city should consider having a public bank. The city council just approved a resolution to initiate a study that would look at the potential benefits that a public bank could bring to Santa Fe. In addressing a city symposium in recent weeks, Mayor Gonzalez gave a passionate outline of the circumstances in his city that lead his administration to look for new options.
Public banking is a critical issue for our community, our state, and by extension, our country. In Santa Fe, we had it better than most during the Great Recession in 2008. But there is no question we felt the pain of that crisis, and that recovery has been slow and a difficult road to travel. Nearly 7 years later, I am convinced that the landscape of private finance has shifted fundamentally. Banks are consolidating and growing larger and are becoming further removed from local communities. Community banks are struggling to compete. High finance, the world of collateralized debt and derivatives that helped trigger the crisis, is still the place that big banks look to, often with the money that local people deposit, only to turn a quick profit. What's lost in the balance is no small thing. Infrastructure, our local people. These are our priorities. But today's financial system has no interest in investing in them. Small business loans from the largest four banks is down more than 50%. Creditworthy people in Santa Fe who want to start a business, expand production, hire new workers, build a new physical plant. The folks we're betting on to make our future stronger, they are getting locked out of a credit market that has never fully recovered from the bad bets of the biggest Wall Street lenders. So what's out there now isn't working. What's next? Well, I believe we had to get creative about our financial solutions. And a public bank is a big leap in that conversation. Just think about it. We are here today to explore the possibility of taking our money, which right now is being invested all over the world, and bringing it home to Santa Fe, where we can put it to work for all of us. It's an incredibly exciting possibility. From helping local businesses secure credit to helping local community banks compete and make more loans, to helping the city finance critical infrastructure projects like expanding high-speed broadband internet. If we can make a public bank work, the possibilities are endless.
That's Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez, providing a comprehensive look at the challenges to municipal finance and the promise that public banking brings to the stage. While the number of cities and municipalities interested in creating a public bank grow, on an individual level, people are finding their way to this issue for a variety of reasons. Like Roxy Dechter is in the southern part of New Jersey, who works on public banking with the New Jersey Public Bank Project. I asked Roxy what was important to her about doing this project at this point.
Actually, when I found out that the Federal Reserve is no more federal than the Federal Express, then I knew the party's sort of the game is rigged. Now I feel I have sort of a basic understanding of what the financial stakes are in our country and even around the world. I hope that enough people wake up to this idea because it's a marvelous idea.
And when asked why it's become so important to her to pursue, Roxy said,
I think our democracy is in dire danger, and I think that we've heard that echoed throughout our history. Don't want to sound negative, but I'm kind of thinking we're close to the cliff and going to go off soon if we don't turn ourselves around.
That's Roxy Dechter from South Jersey, working with the New Jersey Public Bank Project. If you'd like to know more about public banks, you want to read up on how they work, what they do, what's going on around the country and near you, visit the new Public Banking Institute website, which has been redesigned and will be adding substantial new resources for study and for action. Included in this new site is a section called the New Economy Academy, in which primary topics are discussed in depth. This new academy is going to be expanding with resources and course materials in the coming months, and we'll be telling you about them as they materialize. You can visit the site and explore on your own at www.publicbankinginstitute.org. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.